From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with John Morris, who has composed the music for every film by Mel Brooks. For their first comedy, The Producers, they wrote Springtime for Hitler, one of the most flamboyantly tasteless songs ever written. Also today, sports writer Tom Boswell discusses his new book on golf, a sport he calls a lifetime form of masochism. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a new recording by alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, and David Bianculli previews the Charles Kuralt anniversary special showing this week on CBS. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is composer John Morris. He's written the music for all of Mel Brooks's films. In each film, Morris has parodied a different genre of music. He spoofed Broadway musicals in The Producers, westerns in Blazing Saddles, suspense in High Anxiety, horror in Young Frankenstein, and biblical epics in The History of the World Part 1. Morris has also written the scores for more serious films, like The Elephant Man, for which he received an Academy Award nomination. He began his musical career with the intentions of becoming a concert pianist, but early on, he turned to composing and arranging for Broadway musicals. He's done 27 musicals. The last was Mac and Mabel. Morris won 3 Emmys for his television work. His TV work includes The Tap Dance Kid and The Addams Chronicles. His latest movie is another collaboration with Mel Brooks. This one is a spoof of the Star Wars sagas. It's titled Spaceballs, and Spaceballs opens nationally on June 24th. John Morris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I want to mention we're going to be hearing a wide variety of the music you've written as we proceed through today's program. Let's start with the first song that you wrote with Mel Brooks, a song called Springtime for Hitler, which I think it's fair to say is one of the most tasteless songs ever written.
That was the entire intention. Mel came to me and he said, this is the lyric. I want you to make the worst dance arrangement that has ever been heard on Broadway. And Alan Johnson and I collaborated on putting this horrible number on the stage.
It's a big musical production number, Springtime for Hitler.
The worse it is, the better it is, because we were doing just that. When I first read the lyric, I couldn't believe my eyes.
What was the most weird thing to you about the lyric?
Deutschland is happy and gay. I mean, it's insane.
And the idea behind the musical, the idea behind The Producers, the movie that this was written for, was to produce a musical so bad that it would have to fail.
Right. And the number was to be the peak of the musical.
Did you have any reservations about writing this number?
Yes. I said to my wife, I don't know whether I should put my name on this picture. And that's the absolute truth, because I thought it might be so terrible. But one gets to trust Mel after a while. His extravagance, he's always very true to his ideas and has been. He always does exactly what he intends. And is responsible for exactly what he intends to do. So I knew it would be all right.
Let's listen to Springtime for Hitler, and then we'll talk about some of the musical conventions of Broadway that you brought into this song. And this is Springtime for Hitler, orchestrated by my guest, composer John Morris.
Germany was having trouble. What a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory.
Where could that man be?
We looked around and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to pace. Look out, here comes the master race.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Winter for Poland and France.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Springtime for Hitler from the film The Producers, a film by Mel Brooks. My guest composer John Morris orchestrated that number that we just heard.
That is really shameless. You know who the principal vocalist is? The tenor Artie Rubin, who is now general manager for the Niederlander organization. And he's a big, big businessman in the New York theater now, and a great singer.
You know what I'm wondering? You had done a lot of work on Broadway at the time that you were writing this.
Yes.
And you parody so many Broadway musical conventions in the number that we just heard.
I know them all.
I wonder if your fellow composers were almost, if they laughed along with you or if they were a little insulted by it.
No, I don't think so. No, why? It's Julie Stein. It's everybody.
It's everybody, yeah.
Sure.
Let's talk about some of the conventions that you parodied in there.
Sure.
Key changes, tempo changes.
Everything. Every arranging trick. The arranger discovers the secret of arranging is to save. You save everything. You start small. You add instruments. You add voices. You do tempo changes. You do key changes. It's all of that. That's what an arranger learns.
Now, it must have taken a lot of courage to do this, partly because it's such a funny spoof about Broadway, but also because for people who don't get the joke, it would be very offensive to do a big musical comedy number about Hitler.
When, this is a true story, Mel and I screened the film in a screening room in New York for Joe Levine, the producer, and Mel was very nervous. Joe Levine never laughed once. And the picture opened to fairly good reviews and then over the years became a classic. But I don't think it made its money back on the first run, which is frightening for a filmmaker. So, but Joe Levine never laughed.
Did he like it though?
I don't know. He never laughed though, which is the way a person shows an appreciation for a comedy, you know.
I have to ask you this because you work with Mel Brooks. Are you Jewish?
No.
Does he have to tell you all the Jewish in-jokes in his lyrics and in the stories?
No, I know most of the words.
You know?
Sure. It's an accident of birth I'm not, though.
How did you two start working together?
We were called in to doctor a show called Eartha Kitt, Shinbone Alley. He was doctoring the book and I was doctoring the music. And we met in these dingy hotel rooms late at night and tried to bring some life into this Archie and Mehitable show. It was impossible, but that's where we met.
So you were both doctoring this play together?
Doctoring and play together.
What made you realize you'd hit it off together?
We just liked each other tremendously. And I understand him and he understands me. He loves music. You know, in The Producers, for instance, the fountain sequence when they go around the fountain, it's a natural idea to have a big piece of musical elevation. And when we were mixing it, he said, take the fountain down and bring the music up, because he knows that's where all the emotion is. So,
how do you work together? Do the lyrics come first? Sammy Cahn always says the phone call comes first, so I always hesitate to ask this question.
I don't know. I was trying to remember Blazing Saddles. I know there was a piano in the outer office. I know we would go to the piano, and he would say, what do you think of this? And I'd say, what do you think of this? And before we knew it, there was a song. And I don't know really when it happened, because the next day we played it for his wife, Anne Bancroft, and she said, it's wonderful. So I don't know when it happened, but it, these creative accidents are very frightening, because you hope you'll always come up with a thing that is necessary.
I want to play the theme that you wrote for Blazing Saddles.
Sure.
And this is a spoof of Westerns.
Right.
And before we hear it, what did you have in mind? What particular songs or movies did you have in mind when you wrote this theme?
It's none of them. It's the harmonic Western language is all it is. It's a perfectly good song.
It's a great song. You know, that's the thing.
It's just the harmonics of the Western song. The whips are my wife's idea.
Oh, they're perfect.
And
we'll hear in a second.
Sure.
There's whips in it. Now, I have to ask you, you got Frankie Lane to sing the song.
Yes.
And he recorded High Noon, the theme from High Noon.
Right.
He also recorded the theme from Rawhide, which has whips in it, like this song.
Well, that I didn't know. I didn't know about Rawhide.
Was he offended or delighted when you approached him to do a parody of himself?
No, he loved it.
He loved it.
He loved it.
Okay, let's hear the song that he loved recording. This is Blazing Saddles, with lyrics by Mel Brooks, music by my guest John Morris.
He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way. When outlaws ruled the West and fear filled the land, a cry went up for a man with guts, take the West in hand. They needed a man who was brave and true, with justice for all as his aim. Then out of the sun rode a man with a gun, and Barton was his name. Yes, Bart was his name. He rode a blazing saddle.
It's an excerpt from the theme for the Mel Brooks comedy Blazing Saddles. The music was written and orchestrated by my guest John Morris, who has done the music for all of Mel Brooks's films. Now, I would hold that song up against all of the Frankie Lane Western songs and say, if you were listening to it straight, if you weren't thinking of it as a comedy, it would be as good as all of the
straight
ones. Yeah.
It is a straight song. It only happened to be written 10 years later.
That's right.
I just remembered, Mel always wanted to call Blazing Saddles Black Bart. That was his title for the picture. Month after month, he insisted that it be called Black Bart, and the studio loved Blazing Saddles. I don't know how anybody could have been so wrong, but he really would not accept it until the last minute.
Do you have to really love the kind of music that you're parodying when you write music with Mel Brooks? Love
sure.
The genre.
Yeah. I am emotional. That's the kind of composer I am. And if there are good things in every form, you have to find where the heart of it is and then go from the emotion. I mean, all these songs are emotional. They're not they have something in their own right. I hate flat tunes that don't have any inner life. I love great harmonization of something. I love what they call in music suspensions, in which something travels around inside a chord.
I bet you also have an affection for flamboyantly bad music.
flamboyantly, for instance, what's flamboyantly bad?
Well, certain, say certain game show themes, certain really bad musicals. I bet you, even a certain affection for Muzak, maybe, just for all
what
the
is,
corny
yes.
things
yes.
that they do
absolutely
to good
true.
Music.
Absolutely true, yeah.
Do you listen to it so that you get ideas for parodies?
No. No. I mean, I deal with music all the time, so I don't know what I'm dealing with.
Okay. My guest is John Morris, and we're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back to talk more about John Morris's composing for the screen. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Composer John Morris is my guest. He's written the music for all of Mel Brooks's films, including The Producers, Blazing Saddles, High Anxiety, and The History of the World Part 1. Their new collaboration is a Star Wars takeoff titled Spaceballs, and that premieres nationally on June 24th. And in a few minutes, we'll hear a preview of the music from that movie. We've been talking about the parodies that you've written, but you've written a lot of serious music. And it's interesting that both you and Mel Brooks have this serious side, which a lot of people don't know about.
In the, in the East, I'm known as a serious composer. I do Shakespeare's chorus, a lot of things for PBS, The Adams Chronicles. In the West, I'm known as a comedy composer. Never the twain shall meet. There's nothing I can do. Elephant Man, when I was nominated for an Academy Award, my phone didn't ring for about 16 months. After the nomination, my agent never called me. I think somehow he thought I had betrayed him by doing Elephant Man. It's absolutely the truth.
You mean because it was serious?
I don't know. I mean, but I did a very serious film, which got nominated, and then everything went quiet. You know, when the phone doesn't ring, you know you're in terrible trouble. From
would you consider your parody music any less important than your serious music?
No, it's all the same. It's all the same. I mean, it takes the same amount of attention, same amount of care. Sure.
I consider film music to be some of the most important orchestral music of the 20th century, and I think that's probably you agree.
Absolutely, absolutely. When they review the music of say the 30s to the 90s of our time, they're going to find that. A lot of the inspiration, genuine inspiration, comes from film music. Alfred Newman, John Williams, I mean, all the good, wonderful symphonic fellows.
Bernard Herrmann,
sure.
But do you find that a lot of people don't take movie music as seriously as they take music that's made for concert hall performances?
Yeah, it doesn't make a bit of difference because it will go into the repertory. It will just enter. You never can kill a good piece of music. You can't do it. So it will enter the repertory. People won't want to hear it again, and they will.
I want to play some of the music you wrote for The Elephant Man, which is we're going to hear a scene that's the nightmare scene, the music that you wrote for that. Would you describe where this fits into the movie, and then we'll listen to the
yeah.
music?
They enter the Elephant Man's room.
We should maybe just describe who the Elephant Man is.
The Elephant Man is a badly disfigured human being. I forget the name of his disease, but it's rampant fleshly growth is what it is. He's very ugly. And these people come to the room to torment him, to show him off to the local girls. They're all half drunk, and they dance with him and torment him. And this is what I call the nightmare.
Let's hear it. It's a really chilling piece of music.
Yeah, it was. I was just remembering how it took me about, in doing a film score, you always try to arrive at the emotional heart of the film. And it took me a long time, about 3 weeks, to arrive at the kind of music I thought Elephant Man should have. I knew it should be very simple, have a slightly circusy overtone, very legitimate, you know. But it took me a long time, because you go to bed with the problem and you wake up with the problem, and then you feel the steel ball in your stomach, and you go to bed with the problem and you wake up with the problem, and you say, will it never come? Oh, please, will it? Please give me that. Finally it comes. But it takes a long, it took a long time, Elephant Man.
That music is almost like the nightmare side of circus music.
That's right.
Let's talk about how you score for what's happening visually in a movie. The sequence that we just heard is probably a good example of that. This had to work with everybody breaking into the room and tormenting the Elephant Man. Did you see the footage before you scored the music?
I have to explain a little bit about my working method. I memorize the film, the entire film from beginning to end. I know it as well as the director does, because then it begins to take on a life of its own. You really understand the sequences. For instance, this nightmare scene. I discovered it was a ballet. They were talking, but what they were saying had no importance at all. So I decided to just cover it up and score it as I would a ballet. And that was the heart of it. But you can't get that information from reading descriptions. You can't get it from the script. You can't get it from descriptions of what happens when and in how many seconds. You have to get it from the film itself. That's my working method.
So you watch the footage over and over,
over and
again?
Over until I memorize it. I memorize the film, literally. I know it as well as the director does.
How much do you talk to the director before composing?
Oh, a lot, a lot. There's something formally called a spotting session in which you discuss where the music is to occur in the film. And then you go off and do your work. And you may find there are better places or not so good, but
the director of Elephant Man was David Lynch, who also directed
wonderful
Blue
director,
Velvet.
Wonderful director.
So you'd play him fragments.
I play him everything, but it was all finished by the time I had played it for him.
What happens if it's not synchronizing quite right? Do you ever have to speed up the tempo or take it down to synchronize? And do you conduct it while you watch the movie?
Yeah.
What's that experience like?
It's fun. It's fun. No, of course you. Part of my technique as a professional is to make it fit perfectly, which every good film composer does that, because they edit the film. They take out little hunks, so you have to make it work. Mel was editing Spaceballs right up to the final mix.
Spaceballs is the new movie that you did
movie,
with Mel Brooks
right.
That's going to come out on June 24th nationally.
I think it's 26th. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
Could be. Could be the 24th.
Okay. None of us have seen the movie yet. What? It's a spoof of the Star Wars saga?
Yes. Little Star Wars, Little Wizard of Oz, Little Jedi. It's Mel's view of the space cliches of spaceships and little guys and good guys and bad guys and the space adventure film.
What did he tell you he wanted musically?
Star Wars. I mean, I always do my own thing. I can't do Star Wars, but he said this is what this movie is about. Star Wars was a big symphonic. I happen to admire the Star Wars score very, very much, but it's a big symphonic explosion, is what it is. So that's what I did.
Well, you've wrote a test pressing.
Yes, it is a test pressing.
So we're going to sample. What are we going to hear? The overture?
Main title.
Main title. Yeah. Overtures for Broadway.
Yeah. Same thing.
So this is the main title from the new movie, Spaceballs.
Right.
Thank you.
pull out all the stops on that one.
The laser flashes. We have to let the audience know what it's in for. That's the obligation of a main title. The range of the movie, the fun of the movie. That's why those laser flashes are there.
Has John Williams, who wrote all the Star Wars scores, heard this one yet?
No, no. He'll like it. It's a perfectly legitimate piece of English bombast is what it is. You know that. And he wrote a lot of that stuff.
Do you think that soundtracks are changing now, that movie music is changing? And here's what I'm thinking, that a lot of soundtracks now have synthesizer accompaniment, or they have rock hits from the past that are packaged together in anthologies that sell as well as the movie does.
Yeah.
Is that affecting work for movie composers?
Yeah, you understand that the films are slated for the 12 to 17 years old, to 17 year olds. So you have to provide something for them. However, the synthesizer score to me is when it's done with the there's tons of synthesizer in Elephant Man, tons of it, but you don't hear it. I mean, it's all when it's a synthesizer score, it's very boring, in my humble opinion, because everything is flat. It's the big Wurlitzer organ gone berserk. And the rock score, I have nothing against rock scores. I like rock songs myself, but it's for the kids. That's who it's for.
So,
and in a few years, it's going to be embarrassing because that material is going to be so dated, and then you're going to come back and look at the film in 8 years and say, oh, my, what were we doing?
One more thing before we're out of time. What's your next project after Spaceballs?
They're talking to me about it. I have a number of my own projects. Where I have written an opera, a television opera called Stefan, which I want to get on. I've written a show with N. Richard Nash, which I want to get on. I mean, and I'll do some art songs for myself this summer, but movies I don't know about yet.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to meet you. I love your music, and it's been a pleasure to listen to it and to meet you today. Thank you very much for joining us today. My guest has been composer John Morris, and he's written music for all of the Mel Brooks films and also wrote the music for The Elephant Man, which got him an Academy Award nomination. And their latest collaboration is titled Spaceballs. That's a takeoff on the Star Wars sagas. Spaceballs is scheduled to open June 24th or June 26th. It's one or the other. This is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with singer-songwriter Joe King Carrasco, and he's one of the top performers of Tex-Mex music. That's the fusion of rock and Chicano music. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with sports writer Tom Boswell. Boswell's taken up golf as the subject of his new book, Strokes of Genius. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis comments on the reappearance of alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, who's making a comeback after his release from prison in 1985. TV critic David Bianculli previews an upcoming Charles Kuralt 20th anniversary special on CBS, and we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have this news. This is Fresh Air. We're going to hear about alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, who's making a comeback. Morgan made his New York debut last December at the Village Vanguard. His new album, Bebop Lives, was recorded during that engagement. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has this review.
The hottest new name in jazz isn't some young Turk. It's a 53-year-old alto saxophonist who sacrificed his youth to heroin. His name is Frank Morgan. In the 1950s, Morgan was one of a legion of musicians who were doomed to heroin addiction by their worship of Charlie Parker, whose habit was as mammoth as his genius. In 1955, a few months after Parker's death, Morgan's first album was released, with hard sell liner notes proclaiming Morgan the new Charlie Parker, but there was no chance of that. By that time, Morgan was well on his way to supporting a $1,000-a-day drug habit by forging checks and fencing stolen goods. He was first arrested in 1953. He spent the better part of the next 30 years in Los Angeles County jails and California state prisons. His last release from prison was in 1985. He's clean now, a free man with three much-praised albums to his credit. All this makes him good copy, and I suspect that, rather than his musicianship, is why you've read about him in Newsweek and seen him on CBS Sunday Morning. The mass media have no great love for jazz, but they do love success stories, especially at this point, a success story whose moral can be boiled down to the simplistic slogan, "Just Say No." But Morgan isn't the target of my cynicism. He has more going for him than his wayward past. Players who emerge from oblivion to cause as big a stir as he has are generally either prophets or anachronisms, but Morgan is neither. He plays bop, still the most prevalent form of modern jazz, some 40 years after its first manifestation. But he plays it with a keening urgency that inspires fantasies of the bygone era when Charlie Parker himself held sway, before bop hardened into cliché. That was the inevitable price bop paid for becoming the dominant form of modern jazz. At the same time, Morgan displays a willingness to use slightly overblown notes and other techniques identified with free improvisation to give bop an unexpected modern spin. Here's a good example of what I mean. His solitary wail of an introduction to All the Things You Are from his new album Bebop Lives, recorded in performance last December at New York's Village Vanguard. Thank you. Alto saxophonist Frank Morgan and All the Things You Are from Bebop Lives, his latest album on Contemporary Records. Morgan shares his idol Charlie Parker's speech-like delivery, his courtly approach to melody, and his gift for transforming every number into the blues. In other words, like Parker, Morgan has what I like to call the common touch. It's the ability to communicate with the unschooled listener, even while improvising complex harmonic lines. Morgan is capable of running chord changes with the best of them. But to my way of thinking, the most convincing displays of his artistry come during those passages when he reminds us that bop holds potential for soul-searching introspection as well as chest-thumping exhibitionism. Bebop Lives pleases me more than I thought a collection of jazz standards could at this point, no matter how expertly played. That might be because there's a healthy measure of emotion here, along with the requisite technical flourishes. Bebop Lives, all right. The breath of life that Frank Morgan gives it is enough to convince even a skeptic like me.
Jazz critic Francis Davis reviewed Frank Morgan's new album, Bebop Lives. Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is sports writer Tom Boswell. He's been writing about sports for the Washington Post since 1969. He's become nationally known for his articles and books about baseball. But his readers might be surprised to learn that Boswell is just as passionate about another sport, golf. So much so that he's collected his newspaper and magazine pieces about golf into a new book titled Strokes of Genius. Boswell admits that golf is not for everybody, and his colleagues at the Post ribbed him when he offered to cover golf. I asked Boswell why he loves a sport that so many other writers find dull.
Back when I took over golf, most people thought it was at the same level as covering boomerang contests and 5 a.m. bicycle races. Not a popular sport to cover, largely I think because it's not controversial. I liked it for just that reason. I think that golf is the last really civilized sport that we have. A lot of the things that make other sports controversial are also things that to me make them unpalatable. Labor strikes, drug testing, fixing of games, scandals about point shaving. Not only does the golf tour have an honor code, but it's one that players impose on themselves. I've been around golf for almost a dozen years now, and I find it refreshing to go back to a sport that still has the original simple values that it had 50 years ago or more.
You know, and I know that a lot of people have negative predispositions about golf. What are some of the reasons, do you think, that people who don't like golf don't like it?
I think that one of the reasons is that it was a country club sport for a long time. Now the large majority of golfers are public course golfers. Even on the professional golf tour, you find now that instead of playing at ritzy country clubs like Congressional Country Club in Washington, for instance, the tour is building players' clubs which are really public facilities, stadium golf courses where the fan is put first, where he doesn't feel like he's interloping on someone else's ritzy private club.
You describe golf as a humbling game, and you say that golfers are ingrained with a constant acceptance of failure.
I think that's one of the reasons that golfers sometimes seem dull. The sort of mental health that's required to play golf is slightly different than some other sports. In golf, you always are going to have to constantly struggle to regain your form. Even a player as good as Nicklaus loses it constantly and only finds his best form for a week or a month at a time. And I think that that golfers, with the exception of certain people like Lee Trevino and Fuzzy Zeller, who laugh their way through the sports and fight off the pressure in that way, golfers tend to have a sort of a low-flame asceticism about themselves. They tend to be a little bit like flagellates who send themselves to the practice range to hit 1,000 balls to atone for their double bogeys. The fact that you're so self-reliant in golf that you can't blame anyone else for your mistakes, I think tends to bring out the Puritan streak in some golfers. They say, oh, it's my own fault. I can't blame anyone for this when I now have to go hit 1,000 practice putts. And so I think that that golfers tend to almost break themselves on the wheel of their discipline.
Are you a golfer?
Yes.
When did you start?
Oh, more than 20 years ago. It's sort of a lifetime form of masochism. every year you tell yourself that you're going to devote yourself, dedicate yourself, take some lessons, and really get that handicap down into single digits. And every year you go out and find out that you just don't have the character to pull it off. So you go out and throw clubs again.
You really hung up on this thing about character, about how it really takes character to build a good golf game.
I think that the sports you're attracted to are those that in some sense reflect personal values that you have. I've always loved baseball and golf most because I thought that the qualities that those sports demanded were the ones that I respected the most. That doesn't mean that other people wouldn't like other sports for other reasons. I love the dailiness of baseball, that is, that you have to come ready to play 162 days a year, that the spectacular and the mundane are sort of equally valued. And in golf, I respect the cultivation of both your natural temperament and what you might call your anti-self. If you're naturally a person with a lot of temper like I am, you have to learn to control that temper. You have to, you can't smolder on the golf course. You have to learn self-control. On the other hand, if you tend to be sort of a placid, phlegmatic person, I think you need to learn to generate something opposite to that, or else you can't maintain a good enough level of intensity to play the game. So I like it for that reason. I think character is not an out-of-place word.
Can you compare writing about baseball and writing about golf?
I think when you write about baseball, you're operating from an enormous body of lore and an enormous level of common understanding among the fans that are reading it. Also, your accessibility to the players is absolutely unique. To be able to sit around for a couple of hours before games telling tales and swapping lies and then talk after games gives a real sense of being inside the game. And for that reason, I think baseball will always be the best writing sport, and it is better writing sport than golf, though only by a level. In golf, I think that you as a writer have to do a great deal more imaginative work at trying to get inside the player or performer's head. I think it helps if you follow him around the course. There's nothing more organic than a round of golf. If you watch from one shot to the next, you can see the wheels wobbling or coming off, or you can see a player's confidence coming together to the point where he can play several holes at a level of brilliance, as Jack Nicklaus did on the final nine holes of the Masters in 1986. That's really stunning. So I think that you have to do more creative work as a writer covering golf. You have to put more of yourself into it. In baseball, it almost comes and sits at your feet and offers you one wonderful thing after another.
You know, as an interviewer, I could say that I think there's been very little that I've read that has been really interesting about interviewing. And one of the most interesting things I've ever read about interviewing is something that you wrote in an Esquire article in 1982. And I'd like to read you a passage from that and still see if you still...
It's interesting.
Believe what you wrote about this, so can I give it a shot?
Sure.
Great. You wrote that it's a psychological perversity in human nature that people are more likely to speak honestly and even movingly to strangers or to people they half know but respect than they are to most friends? Why do you think psychiatrists sit behind you, scribble in their notepads, speak in prodding, monosyllabic questions, and make particularly sure that you don't get to know them too well? They're just reporters who never file a story. The writer's principle is the same. Be empathetic, be decent, but don't be phony and pretend you're a friend.
I absolutely believe that. I find there are a lot of reporters who get to know players very well in baseball, or in, not so much in golf, but in baseball, I'll say. They're really buddy-buddy, maybe even pitch batting practice or go drinking. And I think that that gives the illusion of closeness, and it may help you find out who hates the general manager and find out details at a very small level. But I also think that it hurts you when you try to get that person to talk about the deepest things that's going on in his life, his lack of confidence, where he finds his strength. I think if you keep your distance, you're much more likely to get the really telling psychological insight or the really honest exposure of personality.
Is it easy for you to keep the right amount of distance from the athletes who you cover?
I don't think that there is one athlete in the world that knows that I have a six-month-old baby.
Really?
So I don't think there's one athlete in the world who's ever met my wife, been to my house, and there probably aren't five that I've ever gone to dinner with. I don't think that's necessary. I think it tends to lead you into being a fraud around them, giving them the impression that you're going to cut them a break, or when their career is about over, you're going to write the column that's going to save them and give them an extra year or prevent the trade they don't want. I think there's sort of an implicit lie in it, and I'm much more comfortable with distance. It's natural to me, so I won't tout it as a virtue. It's my nature.
When you were young, did you want to be either an athlete or a sports writer?
I certainly never kidded myself about being an athlete, and given the choice, wouldn't have wanted to be one. Still wouldn't if there were a magic wand today. I would much rather be a writer than any sort of athlete in the world, even Jack Nicklaus. I think just writing's a higher calling. And a better one. I'd rather be a second- or third-rate writer, which is probably where I am, than a first-rate athlete.
How come?
Oh, right. Athletes' performances are written on water. I think athletes barely even understand what they're doing. I think it's more fascinating to understand someone than it is to hit a ball in a hole.
Tom Boswell, thank you very much for talking with us.
I really enjoyed being on with you. Thanks a million.
Tom Boswell's new book about golf is titled Strokes of Genius. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, we have two stories on South Korea, on the continuing violent student demonstrations there, and also on the years-long standoff between the government of President Chun Doo-hwan and its opponents. A Supreme Court ruling also, the impact of a murder on the victim's family may not be considered by juries deliberating on whether to impose the death penalty. Also, out of Washington State, two climbers who died earlier this month near the summit of Mount Rainier left behind a videotape of their final days on the mountain, and we have a story on that.
Well, thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Each weekend, CBS correspondent Charles Kuralt is in New York to host the program CBS Sunday Morning. But during the week, he's often on the road, usually a back road. This week, CBS is presenting a Kuralt retrospective. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
The last few months, I felt more like a funeral director than a critic. We've had to bury Hill Street Blues, Prairie Home Companion, and Our World. Now, thank goodness, comes a broadcasting event that's a celebration, and a show that's very much alive after 20 glorious years. Well, maybe calling it a show is pushing things a bit. Wednesday night, CBS is presenting a primetime special called 20 Years on the Road with Charles Kuralt. It honors that series of offbeat, off-the-beaten-path stories that Kuralt started doing for the CBS Evening News back when Lyndon Johnson was still in the White House. It's possible, and even probable, that Kuralt has been able to pursue his on-the-road pieces for so long because it keeps him and CBS at a comfortable distance. He doesn't have to deal with a network on a daily basis, and they don't have to deal with him. The stories he turns in never have news hooks, so they can be used or held in reserve until a few minutes of lighter, happier material is called for. For Kuralt, it's a dream job. He and photographer Izzy Bleckman and sound engineer Larry Gianeschi tour the back roads of America in a van and talk to people the evening news would otherwise ignore. Some of the more eccentric ones are even ignored by their own small-town neighbors, but Kuralt gives each person he encounters a large dose of respect. That's the difference between on the road and such forgettable imitations as real people. In this week's collage of on-the-road reports of the last 20 years, you'll meet Esther Wright of St. Petersburg, Florida, otherwise known as the Bird Lady, who rides around town on her bike feeding animals. And John Volker, a Michigan Supreme Court justice and novelist who walked away from his careers once he had enough money to do what he always wanted to do, fish for trout every day of the season. Many people feel that Kuralt has the best job in television, but in the report on that trout fisherman, you sense that Kuralt knows of at least one man who's got it even better. TV news would be a lot less compassionate, though, if Kuralt were fishing for trout instead of stories. Doing sentimental stories well isn't one of the strong points of a network news organization, as they proved last year on a massive scale with their brain-dead feature stories about the Statue of Liberty celebration. Kuralt, though, is a master. It's not just that Kuralt finds such interesting people. What counts most is what he does when he finds them. Most of the time, he lets them speak for themselves in accents and uninterrupted thoughts seldom heard on the evening news. One of the stories in this week's anthology is about Nick and Tony Venatucci, two farmers in Colorado Springs who plant acres of pumpkins each fall so local kids can come out and take home the pumpkin of their dreams for free. Kuralt talks to the brothers about why they do this, and then he just stands back and observes the kids. The images are priceless, but Kuralt's narration is pretty special too.
We watched LaDonna Bearden, 6 years old, dance across the furrows toward the one out of so many thousands that she had identified from afar as the perfect pumpkin. We watched Andy Salazar, 6 years old, pumpkinless, among those who had already found their pumpkins, bump along, studying the ground, until he too found bright orange fulfillment.
Many of the stories in this 20-year anniversary special will be familiar because a lot of Kuralt's on-the-road reports are impossible to forget. The one I wish was included, though, is an early story Kuralt did about the amazing swimming pig some Midwestern farmer talked Kuralt into filming and putting on the air. It wasn't until after the report was broadcast by CBS that Kuralt heard from farmers all over the country, all bearing the same message. "You idiot," they told him, "all pigs can swim." Kuralt likes to tell that story, and I think he likes it because it goes to the heart of what he's been proving for 20 years with his on-the-road stories. Just because some guys have the cameras and the microphones, it doesn't mean they have all the answers.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with composer John Adams. He's at work on a three-act grand opera titled Nixon in China. It premieres in October at the Houston Opera. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will introduce us to The Creation, a short-lived British art school band that he thinks was the equal of The Who. And book critic John Leonard will review Michael Crichton's new suspense novel, Sphere. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. He directed today's show. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Research assistants from Sue Spolin and Karen Merdrick. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Thank you. This is NPR, National Public Radio.